Okay, the subject today, we said, is Jewish music or music by Jews. And there is a big difference, as we know, that not all Jewish music or not all music by Jews is Jewish music. And I'd like to look a little bit about what the concept of music is in Judaism. I had a student, actually, at Or HaSameach about 12 years ago, who was a classical violinist. And he said that he wanted to speak to someone about music, wanted to ask certain questions about music, and he wanted to really speak to some high-level Torah scholar about what Judaism says about particular music. And so I said, I'll take you to my teacher, Rav Moshe Shapiro, and I'll translate for you. So we went to Rav Moshe Shapiro to speak to him about music, Jewish music, classical music, etc. It was a very, very interesting conversation. And much of this class is based on that conversation. But I remember one of the first things that the fellow said to Rav Moshe was, he says, I'm a professional musician. I really do not enjoy listening to guys singing Jewish music. He says, they're always off key, they're out of tune, the harmony is off. I can't stand it. It really, really annoys me. Rav Moshe Shapiro said, me too. It's his first response. And so anyway, I'd like to talk a little bit about the importance, first of all, of music in Judaism. We know that our Torah is written as a Torah Shebichtav, a written Torah. And the written Torah is really a closed book. If you don't have certain features, the oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, to explain, to elaborate, and to actually bring it from the, like, so to speak, from heaven to earth, which is what the oral Torah does. A large part of it, if you look at the Torah itself, aside from the fact that there's no vowel sounds, there also is no punctuation. There is nothing to tell you where to end the sentence, the beginner sentence, where to pause in the sentence, what words to emphasize, what words not. You know, if you have a document without punctuation, without emphasis, it's very, very problematic. There's an old Russian story, not that old, but a Russian story about Stalin getting a telegram from Trotsky. As you know, they were enemies. And Stalin gets this telegram from Trotsky, and he reads it out at one of the party congress meetings. And he says, Trotsky, my greatest enemy, has just sent me the following telegram. Dear Stalin, I was wrong. You were right. I should apologize, Trotsky. He says, you see, my greatest enemy has admitted that I am indeed correct. And a Jew in the audience said, Comrade Stalin, may I please read this with greater emotion? And he says, certainly. So the Jew comes up to the podium, takes the telegram and reads it. Dear Stalin, I was wrong. You were right. I should apologize, Trotsky. Went with my kids to Ein Gedi, to the nature reserve. We went swimming there. One of the rangers comes over and he says, can't you read the sign? It says, no swimming allowed. I said, that's how you read it? I read it differently. No, swimming allowed. And obviously, in order to understand any written text, you need to have something which conveys the emotion of the words, something which conveys more than just the words themselves can convey. And the way that we do that in the Torah is, anyone who has been to shul will know, that we never read the Torah in shul. It is always sung. Those notes, the Tameh HaMikra, even though there are differences from community to community in the way that the specific notes are sung, but the notes themselves and the idea behind each note, the emotion conveyed by the notes, the pause, the continuity, the emphasis, they are all really part of the oral tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh. And so one of the first manifestations of the Torah Shebaal Peh is in fact in music. And it's in music, the music of the Torah, which conveys so much of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah. There are commentaries which are based on the music. A lot of very interesting ideas. As we know, some of the more obvious ones, the Shalsheles, which is a note that wavers back and forth and back and forth and back and forth many times, is obviously, that's a fairly obvious connotation of wavering back and forth, hesitation. Where do we find it? We find it when Lavan is leaving the city of Sodom, despite the destruction raining down on the city of Sodom, he hesitates. We find that, Lot. When Lot is leaving Sodom, he hesitates. We find also that when Yosef comes into the room of the Potiphar's wife, and it says he came in to do his malacha, his work, which the Talmud says is a euphemism that he was ready to succumb to the avera, to the sin, and it says, vayimaen, he refused. But that refusal was not something easy. It was not as if he said, forget it. No, it wasn't. It was vayimaen. On that vayimaen, there's a shalsheles to tell us that there was a lot of struggle that was going on. It was an act of tremendous heroism and very, very difficult for him. We also find that when Moshe Rabbeinu did the last sacrifice, the last korban offering in the dedication of the tabernacle in the desert, vayishchat says he shechted, vayaviyehu, they brought the seer, they brought the goat to him, and he shechted it. That was the last sacrifice he did in the dedication of the tabernacle and of the kahanim, the priests, his brother Aaron and the rest of the priests. And on that word, vayishchat, there is also a shalsheles. What was the hesitation here? What was the wavering back and forth? Because there were mixed feelings here. On the one hand, Moshe Rabbeinu is, of course, engaged in this amazing act of dedication of the entire tribe, the descendants of Aaron, as Kohanim, who will serve in the temple. He is dedicating the temple through this. But what is also happening through this? That's right. He is not going to be able to do this anymore. Because until that moment, Moses, Moshe, had been able to go, he was the one who was bringing korbanos. He constructed the Mishkan. At this point, granted, it was an amazing act of dedication of everyone else, but it also meant the exclusion of himself from that aspect, and of what everything Moshe Rabbeinu wanted was to be close to Hashem. But from this aspect of Avodas Hashem, there was a designation that it would go to the Kohanim. And there also the Torah gives us the note of a shalsheles. And it's interesting, you find also that the notes teach you when there is enthusiasm. There's a note called Kadma Ve'azla, which at least amongst Ashkenazim is sung Kadma Ve'azla, which of course implies enthusiasm. In fact, the word Kadma Ve'azla, Kadma means to proceed, Ve'azla, and means to go forward and to proceed. And that note indicates very often enthusiasm. So we find that one of the manifestations of the oral tradition, one of the ways that we understand the Torah and convey the emotion of the Torah, is indeed through music. And of course, as we know, there are special tunes, like Eicha has its own tune of lamentation, which even in the Megillah, right, there are certain sentences when we talk about Mordechai being exiled from Israel with the Golah, with the exile of Yechoniah, Melech Yehuda, so therefore it is done in the tune of Eicha. Some say that's in order so that the Litvaks can also have some pleasure on Purim to hear some Eicha, a little bit of Eicha. So why do we only do two sentences? Because it's enough. They shouldn't have too much joy. Right? But basically, we do that in the tune of Eicha, which of course anyone who hears the tune, you immediately, right, there's a feeling of sadness in the tune of Eicha, and of course there's a feeling of joy in the tune of the Megillas Esther. So the tune conveys another dimension that you don't only get from the words, and indeed it conveys an entire amount of the Torah Shebaal Peh, where you pause in a sentence is very, very important, as I illustrated. Right? The way you emphasize words, the way you pronounce words, all these are part of music and the role it played in the Torah. We also know that in the Beis HaMikdash, there's a very important part that music played. We know that the Levim would be, there are Meshorarim amongst the Levim, Meshorarim, the singers, and there would also be a Levim who would play musical instruments, Levites, who would play musical instruments in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple in Jerusalem. There are 15 psalms known as the Shir HaMa'alot, the songs of steps, which were sung by the Levim as they stood on the 15 steps going from the Azar into the Heichal, from the outer courtyard into the inner courtyard of the temple. So as the priest would ascend those steps, each of the Levites would be singing these beautiful psalms, which were composed by King David for the purpose of being used in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. Music was also an important part of the entire temple service. In fact, there's a tradition that there was certain music was played for different sacrifices. Different offerings had different music played. For example, if a chatas was brought, a sin offering was brought, there was sad music that was played. Until the moment of Zrikas Hadam, when the blood was placed on the altar, then the music would segue into a happy tune. Because the moment that the offering was accepted, that the person had become once again reunited with God after having severed or cut the distance, the relationship, it would be like a Vivaldi Four Seasons going from winter perhaps into spring, right? And that beautiful segue would go into a very much more happy tune. There's actually a famous story about I think it was the Upta Rav. The Upta Rav was a Hasidic Rebbe who he knew that he had been a Kohen Gadol in a previous life. He was the high priest in the temple in a previous reincarnation. Most people are not aware what they were in a previous incarnation. He was aware of this, and there are a number of stories told about him regarding this knowledge that he had. One of the stories is that during Tish, Friday night, he was sitting with the Hasidim singing, and a man, total stranger, came to the door of the room in which they were singing. The Upta Rav looked at him for a good 30 seconds, 40 seconds, stared at this guy, and then burst out laughing. The guy was very embarrassed and left. He then came back and opened the door again. This time the Upta Rav immediately laughed at him, and the guy left immediately. Hasidim were stunned by what happened. They kept on singing, and you know. But in the morning, the owner of the local inn came over to the Upta Rav and informed him that this fellow had died. This fellow that he laughed at was found dead in his bed. No signs of violence, no signs of suicide, nothing. What should we do? So the Upta Rav said he's Jewish. The Chevra Kedisha should bury him. It was not a suicide. So at this point, people's curiosity could not be contained. They said, well, what's going on? He said, back in the Beis HaMikdash, I was the Kohen Gadol. He says, now, I remember that there was a certain Levite in the band who would continue just a few extra chords of the sad music during the Korban Chatas, the sin offering, even after the moment that it was accepted, in order to rub it in a little bit to the guy who was bringing it. You know, just a little few extra chords on the harp, just to rub in to the guy who was bringing it that he'd done a sin. And he said, once this Levite himself had to bring a sin offering. So all the Levites got together and decided that they're going to make him feel what it's like. They'll make him feel what it is like to embarrass someone. So he brought the sin offering. The entire band kept playing the sad music. A few notes up, and he looked up in confusion, and then it dawned over him what was happening, and he was embarrassed, and they laughed at him. So the Upta Rav says, I couldn't bring myself to laugh at him at that time. I just felt that it was enough that he was embarrassed. I couldn't bring myself to laugh. He says, so anyway, that was 2,600 years ago. And last night, fellow walks in, I look at him. Where do I know this guy from? And I see, he's the lady. Why is he coming back? Why are we meeting? He says, his soul needs to be laughed at. By the equivalent of a Kohen Gadol. He says, I laughed at him. He came back again, he needed more. I laughed at him again. And that was it. His purpose in life was over. The tikkun of the soul was achieved. He died. So that's the story of the Upta Rav, just coincidentally. But I mean, the power of music, we are told that in the Beis HaMikdash itself, music played a very, very important role in all the korbanos. We also know various psukim, but for example, in the book of Shmuel, we are told, and also in Malachim, regarding Elisha, and also regarding Shmuel, that in both of those books, in both of those cases, Shmuel and Elisha, and also regarding Shaul, we are told that their prophecy was dependent to a certain degree on hearing music. In other words, it says, "Vayikanagina menagein," when the musician played his instruments, "Venachalav ruach Hashem," the Spirit of God rested upon them. And the Gemara says, deduces from that indeed this is because ruach hakodesh, prophecy, divine inspiration, can only rest upon a person when they're in a state of simcha, a state of joy. That state of joy was achieved for the prophets. Many of the prophets, by music. So the music brought them to a state of Ruach HaKodesh. And we also know that our tefillos, Tehillim, right? The Tehillim is meant ideally to be sung. We don't really have today much of a tradition about the way Tehillim should be sung, but we know that when the men of the Great Assembly set the prayers and organized the service, they had Psukei Dezimra. The introductory part to davening is called Psukei Dezimra, which means verses of song. And those verses of song are from Tehillim, from Psalms, and of course there, the idea, the purpose of Psukei Dezimra is to elevate a person to a state of, because the Talmud says, you should not pray from a state of depression, from a state of frivolity, from a state of idle conversation, from laziness, rather from a state of simcha shel mitzvah, from being in the joy of a mitzvah, closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so how would you achieve that? You can't just turn that on. But the way that is done is through Tehillim, through Psalms. Of course, if you're in a submarine minyan, right, it's going to be very difficult to get to that. A submarine minyan was a phrase coined by a student of mine at Or Sameach, who felt that he was proficient enough to pray in a regular shul. Or some math, very slow prayers, very slow. Right, so he went to a regular shul. He came back, he said, this guy had been in the submarine, in the submarine unit in the US Navy. And he said the minyan was like submarine warfare. I said, what are you talking about? He said, look, submarine warfare, you surface, scans with the sonar and the periscope on the surface. He then it dives, sprints to another place in the sea. Right, comes up another place, right? She says, the chazan did the same thing. He'd surface and say a couple of verses. He would dive and sprint to this other place. I had no idea how he got there, right? Then he'd surface again and say this other verse. Then he'd dive, surface again somewhere else, and suddenly be shma. And I'm like, I'm putting on my telephone. So that's not what davening is meant to be like. Psukei Dezimra is ideally meant to be some way sung or at least chanted, because that's the way that one gets to a state of simcha shel mitzvah. And it's interesting that this student asked Rav Moshe Shapiro, he said, actually, not only do I not like Jewish music because people don't sing it well, he says, but I also just don't feel I like it. I prefer classical music. I really prefer classical music. And Rav Moshe Shapiro said to him the following. He said, who says that what you call Jewish music and what people call Jewish music is really Jewish music? He said, classical music is probably closer to the music in the Beis Hamikdash than most Jewish music is today. He said, and it was interesting, I did a little research into this. And according to a couple of historians, Will and Ariel Durant, for example, and a couple of others, there is actually a theory that classical, I mean, this is not, part of this is not theory, part of it is, that the classical music developed from traditional Baroque church music, which actually developed from the Gregorian chants. Gregorian chants. The Gregorian chants which was from Christian church in Syria, got their tradition of the chants from apparently the Levites chanting of the Psalms, the Tehillim, in the Beis Hamikdash. Which means there would appear to be a closer line from Handel's Messiah back to the Beis Hamikdash than from Mordechai ben David's Animamim back to the Beis Hamikdash. No offense to Mordechai, but that's what it would appear from what Rav Moshe Shapiro was saying. And it does make sense in some way when you hear, you know, music is not just meant to, is not just meant to give you a beat, right? To imitate the pulse of the body and the music so that you can rock back and forth in your car, you know, to the tune of the Snoop Doggy Dog in the Lincoln Tunnel, etc. Right? But rather it's something which is meant to really inspire and to bring you to a higher level. I think that happens a lot more in something where the music is a lot more complex and a lot of subtleties, which is like classical music. So anyway, that's a little bit of the background of how important music is. Now it's interesting, the Gaon of Vilna discusses the importance of music in the introduction to Pa'as HaShulchan, which is a a section, a book written by Rabbi Yisroel of Shklov, who's a student of the Gaon of Vilna, who together with other students of the Gaon of Vilna went to Israel to settle in the city of Tzfat in the north of Israel. And he wrote a section, an addition, an addendum to the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, of the laws of Eretz Yisroel. And in the introduction there, it's got amazing stuff just to read about the Mesiris Nefesh, the self-sacrifice that the students of the Gaon of Vilna had in settling in Israel, right, makes you understand also, I mean, people often ask, but these crazy people are living in all these weird places in Israel, weird places like Beit Lechem and Beit El and Hebron, and they're going through tremendous Mesiris Nefesh to live there. You read what the students of the Gaon of Vilna, the students of the Baal HaTanya, the students of the Chasan Sofer who came to Israel, they went through the same. They went through, Mesiris Nefesh was incredible in order to live there. So there he writes a little bit of biographical material about the Gaon of Vilna. And he writes, the Gaon of Vilna told him that he said, although speech is the language of the intellect, he said music is the language of the soul. That the language of direct ruchnius is through music. You can reach directly, circumvent the intellect, so to speak, and which often has got all the rationalizations and has got the ego and everything else, and get directly to the soul of the human being. And he said, not only that, the Gaon of Vilna also said, Roiv, the majority, I actually don't even understand this, but I think it's interesting to hear the words. He says, the majority of the secrets of Kabbalah, of mysticism, Jewish mysticism, the majority of the secrets of Kabbalah can be found in music. For one who understands Chochmas HaMuzika, the wisdom of music, he said that indeed most of the secrets of the Kabbalah can be found there. And that's an amazing statement, since I don't know Chochmas, the Chochmah of music, the wisdom of music, and I do not know Kabbalah, so I can't tell you what that means. But it's an amazing statement to make that, the Gaon of Vilna comes along and tells us that music, not only is it the language of the soul, but it has the ability to contain within it all the wisdom of the Kabbalah. I mean, we know, for instance, today that there are those who have found tremendous mathematical patterns in music, which contain within them the secrets of the physical world, the natural world. There's a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is very difficult read. I mean, very difficult read. Gödel, Escher, Bach is a book by a mathematician who has found who talks about Gödel, who was a great mathematician, Escher, who was the famous Dutch artist, master of tessellation and other artistic techniques, filling spaces. But Escher, and also Bach, the great musician, and he points out mathematical patterns that you find in Bach, and which imitate mathematical patterns you find in Escher in the graphics, and which you find in nature itself. So there's certainly, right, even from a purely secular or skeptical perspective, music does contain in it tremendous, tremendous amount of patterns, because it goes beyond words. You see, what are words? The Hebrew word for speech is ledaber. Ledaber, speech. But the word daber actually has another meaning in Hebrew. The meaning in Hebrew of daber, for instance, we say in our apostolic before the blowing of the shofar, it's also actually quoted in the prayer for Tzahal, we said yesterday, right, is the verse, Yadber Sonenu Tachtenu. Yadber Sonenu Tachtenu. What does that mean? It means, may our enemies be conquered. Yadber means to be conquered. So in what way, why would speech and conquest be the same word? In Hebrew, there's no coincidences. The fact that the daber is the same as conquest is very, very significant. So the idea here is the following. What is speech? Speech is taking thought. I mean, spiritual inspiration of the soul inspires thought. And thought, intellectual thought, is something which is very, very up in the air. It is something which is very ethereal. It's something which is not very concrete, and it's difficult to communicate it. When you speak, what you're doing is you're taking your thoughts and you are jamming them into a finite type of medium, and you're putting it into rules of grammar and rules of syntax and rules of logic, and you are really, what you're doing is, it's an act of conquest. Every time we take a thought and put it into words, in a sense, we're conquering the thought. What we're doing is we are compressing it and we are forcing it into a finite, very, very physical communication. And really, thoughts should be higher than that. I mean, if we could do a Vulcan mind meld, that would certainly be better. If we'd all sit here and just do that, right? Wouldn't that be better? If we'd all Spock, right? So that would be ideal. But we can't, if it's for the Trekkies here anyway. But probably not many. Okay. But, oh, there are some. Okay, very good. Well, okay. We can form the Gateway's Trekkies Association afterwards. So... But the Vulcan mind meld would perhaps be the ideal. My thoughts directly to your thoughts. But that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. What I do is I take my thoughts, force it into words, then I communicate the words, you take the words, and, so to speak, unzip the file, and it now goes into your mind. But there's going to be a breakdown. This breakdown, it's not direct. Right? In fact, very often the words that one person says, the words the other person hears, totally different. I go to Shir about Hilchos Pesach. In a community in Toronto, and a woman asked me in the shir if a certain oil from Winnipeg, which was marked, which she said she thought was kosher Pesach, was it okay for Pesach? I said to her the following, this is a direct quote from me, right? I said, if it has a reliable kashrut certification, then it's okay. If it does not have a reliable kashrut certification, it is not acceptable. She then went to a club, then the local rabbi, about 3 days later, he says, I had a strange thing in my class. I was mentioning that this oil that's now being marketed from Winnipeg, I said it doesn't have a reliable hefsher and therefore it should not use it on Pesach. A woman in the class said, excuse me, but Rabbi Becker said it was fine. He said, did you say that? I said, but of course not. Right? Somewhere the dibur process broke down. Communication, and it always does. Right? It always breaks down. Right? So, but dibur is really an act of conquest. It's of taking the thought, compressing it, and putting it into words. Of course, to a great degree, that's what the human being does. But music is a more direct communication. Music is closer to the spiritual and closer to the soul, and hence doesn't have the dibur component of music. It's something where it can convey the feeling and the thought in a much more direct way. In addition to that, music also is something which exists only really on a type of plane which is a little bit beyond the physical. You think about it, let's say that a person had the memory of a goldfish, right? A goldfish has a 3-second memory. Okay, how do I know that? It was the top of a Snapple top, right? But anyway, so according to Snapple, the goldfish has let's say this is true, I don't know, but let's say the goldfish has a 3-second memory. That's where I get most of my information, in general. I drink a lot of Snapple, so. So if you have a 3-second memory, would you be able to appreciate music? See, think of it this way. What is music? Well, it's really the fact that I remember what the previous note was, hear the present note, and anticipate the note to come, okay, is really what the music is. If I would only remember like a second or two of music, what would I hear? Dum. Then I would hear dum. I wouldn't remember what the previous note was, so I'd just hear dum. And then I hear that. Now, but if you hear dum, 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 dum. So when you hear that, right, you say, ah, because you, but it only exists because you remembered what was there and you anticipate what's coming and that you can feel there's a flow and there is a sequence. So really, music is in a sense something which is linking the past and the present and the future. And it's something which is, that's why, by the way, the Maharal discusses this. We'll talk about it, you know, in another class, but when in the songs in the Torah, the Shirim in the Torah, the songs in the Torah start with the word Az. Az Yashu Moshe Bnei Yisrael, so what is Az? The word Az, Aleph Zayin, means, the Gemara says, Yesh Az La'ovar. There is Az, which means then, which means in the past. But we know, the Gemara says, Yesh Az La'osid. There's also Az, which is future. In the future, Az, then, in English also, right? You can say then, meaning past, Oh, yeah, then afterwards, then we, right? Oh, yes, I'll meet you and then we will, right? That's future, right? So in, right, just then, is what is just then in South African? That's like, or just now, I'm sorry, just now, not just then. Okay, so you've got past and you've got future. He said because in a sense, a song is something which is not, which is above time. It's above zman. Right? And because it's something which links together the past, the present, and the future. And indeed, you can recapture totally some past experience very often just by the music of that. That's what we're doing really with Eicha, the tunes of Eicha, with the Megillus Esther, with the Torah itself. We're recapturing some past revelation of Kedusha, of the wisdom of the Torah. We can recapture some of that through the music, because music is in and of itself built of things which are really above the level of past, it links together past, present, and future. The word shir, by the way, in Hebrew, we find in the Mishnah, Mishnaic Hebrew, actually in the Chumash itself, shir in the Chumash, not only does it mean song, but it also means ring. A ring, shir, shirei zahava, rings of gold. In the Mishnah, it refers to shirim. In the Mishnah, Shabbos, refers to the idea of rings as shir, a shir. What is that? Why is it called a ring? Well, according to one, the simple explanation would be that since it does link together the past, present, and future in your mind, that's what links it together. That's where music exists only within the mind of each person who is hearing it. It doesn't exist independently of that. It exists within your mind. So it also, in that sense, links together. It's a shear, it's a circle that links together past, present, and future. But it also is something which we believe also connects, since also it brings you to Ruach HaKodesh, it connects you. It's like a ring also, which is a connecting device, which is something that links past, present, and future. Also, when you think about the octaves, the seven octaves, right, what happens at the end of them, Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do, right? So it goes back around and around, and it indicates the idea of Ruchnius, because Ruchnius doesn't have limitations. The physical world has limitations. In some sense, music is that which is beyond limitations. It's interesting also that Gaon of Vilna points out that although in the present world, in the Beis HaMikdash, it says that the harp of the Levites had seven strings, but in the future we'll have eight. What does that mean? Right? I don't know what it means on the deepest level, but on some level what it might mean is that the music that we have today, right, we have music which is within Teva, seven, symbolic always of nature, the 7 days of creation, right, whereas Aleph, one more than that is eight, right, and eight is always indicative of something just beyond, one step beyond nature, which is what Bruce Miller is. That's also us. As Yashir, the Maharal points out, every song that starts with as is Zayin, which is Aleph, one, and Zayin is seven. It's one Echad Roichev al Shiva. It is one riding, so to speak, or elevated above eight. The times of the Mashiach will be a time when we will be elevated beyond the restrictions of the natural world, and so we'll be listening to a harp, so to speak. I'm not sure what this means in terms of music, but a harp which has got the eight octaves, and will not be just seven, will be the eight, and will be symbolic of the fact that the human being has achieved the level where, I mean, we are told also in Genesis, Bereshis, that God tells Adam and Eve, he says, in the commandment to procreate, he also says, milos aris v'chivshuha, you shall conquer it. What does it mean to conquer it? So some of the commentaries point out what that means is that part of what the human being is supposed to do is to conquer space and time as well. To conquer the world in such a sense that we will achieve a level where we're not restricted anymore by space-time, which of course is what we call Tchias HaMesim, the time of the resurrection of the dead, where we won't be restricted by space-time. The fact that I can't speak to the Rambam is because we're separated by dimensions of time. And that will become a time when, through Ruchnius, through achieving a level of spirituality, where the body, the physical body, will also be elevated, so then we'll achieve a level which is beyond space and time. That is what's symbolized by the eight-ringed harp. In a sense also, shir is called a circle also, because what music can do is bring people together and unite people together. So when you sing with a group, which is really, I think, much of authentic Jewish song was not solos. Very rare do you find a solo in authentic Jewish music all the way back to the Tanakh. It's usually a group singing together.
It's the Levim as a group singing together. It's the Jews as a group singing together. Psukkah de Zimra originally was sung together. In fact, most of davening was sung and chanted in unison in the original. That's originally how it was done amongst the Sephardim. This is still done to a great degree. Amongst the Ashkenazim, it is not done so much. At all, really. But that's how it originally was. The Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says, actually, that that's the origin of shockling. In the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says, why do we shockle? Because the king, pagan king, asked him, why do Jews sway back and forth when they pray? He said, I'll tell you why. I'm quoting this from Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, Rishon. He says, because prayer books were very rare, people would have large prayer books shared by a number of people. He says, since the Hebrew language lends itself to being chanted and sung, and all you need to do is look in to remind yourself of the beginning of a sentence, and the tune will help you with the rest of the sentence. He said, all that was required was for each person to take a turn to look in, and they'd be reminded. He says, so you'd have people standing around, and each one would look in. The next one would look in. The next one would look in. And he says, since people generally imitate what they see without really thinking about it, he says, Jews started, even when they got more prayer books, swaying when they pray. Right? So the origin of shockling, according to Rabbi HaLevi, is actually from the fact that we chanted and sung all the prayers together. And that's really how it was. So the song also is something which unites people together. I feel instinctively that, you know, one of the greatest modern day Jewish musicians was, I think, Reb Shlomo Carlebach. And one of the great things about him, he definitely did not have the greatest voice. As most people will tell you, he didn't have a great voice. I've heard many people with much better voices than Reb Shlomo Carlebach. So what was so good about it is because he didn't have a great voice, anyone can sing his songs. You do not need a synthesizer, an echo chamber, a 17-piece orchestra, right, and reverberating woofers and tweeters, etc., in order to sing. You don't need an operation. You can just sing, right? You can sing it. Everyone can do it. One of the great things about Jewish music is that it should be able to be sung by everyone. This is something which I can access, the type of thing myself. So it's music that connects me to other people as well. Interesting, just, I don't know, I heard this from a friend of mine. He says he got it from a great Rav. I don't know, I can't authenticate this, but he said one of the reasons we dance in circles also is because that links us together. You see, when you see dancing in a goyish environment, right, God forbid, what is it basically? Everyone's in their own world. I mean, it used to be that you'd have two people dancing together. Right, you know, the old style dancing, things like the foxtrot, etc., etc. Two people dance together, just focus on each other. Today, it's not even that. So everyone is basically standing there convulsing, right, by themselves, right, and there's no one. Actually, there was a rock concert, heavy metal concert in Chicago, in which this is reported in the Chicago Tribune, in which one of the guy on the electric guitar. Actually, there was a short circuit, and he was electrocuted, right? And what happened was, he started convulsing, and he was actually thrown off the stage into the audience, and everyone was clapping. They thought it was part of the thing. Right? They thought it was like a mosh pit. What does it say about an art form where a person is convulsing by being electrocuted, and they think he is actually doing some dance? I mean, this is like... So, you've got to ask yourself, where are we going with this? So anyway, it is also, music has got to be something which unites us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and unites us to each other. And that's also another concept of the Jewish music. And that was very, very common in ancient times. It was uniting people together. And so we see that music has a concept of unity, which is past, present, future, me with the other people, accessing my own soul, accessing HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Ruchnius. And in every way, it is something which really does unite. It's interesting, the Maharal tells us in the Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers, a very famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers, which says the world stands on three things. Ala Torah, ala Avodah, val Gmilus Chasodim. On the study of Torah, on the worship of Hashem, prayer, and on kindness to others. The Maharal explains each of these is a different sphere of connection. Torah is connection to your own neshama, to your soul. It's a mitzvah, so to speak, between myself and myself. It is to say, to connect to what is inherent in my neshama, because Torah is inherent in the soul of every Jew, and I am really reconnecting and refining what's already in my soul. It's a connection to self. Avodah is connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Prayer, ultimate connection to Hashem. Gemilus Chasodim is connection to other people. He says it is our purpose in the world to enhance, to actually achieve connection to our own neshama, to the self, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to others. So that also is what something which music does. It actually helps us to achieve each of these things. And the Gemara tells us that Torah is acquired by singing as well. You know, it's an amazing thing. When you sing, when you read Torah, when you learn Torah, traditionally, the minhag of Klal Yisrael, and this minhagim, customs of Jewish people, should not be taken lightly. It's a custom of the Jewish people to sing. It's not like a law library. Right, you go to a law library, all you hear is donuts, you know, coming out of the coffee and into God, pages turning, etc., the occasional sobbing. Right, but basically, in a yeshiva, when we are studying Torah, what do we hear? People are singing, we're chanting it together. You know, and there's an idea of chanting, the singing of the Gemara. You know, very often I remember a Rebbe telling me that about a certain student, he doesn't have the singing down right. His Gemara is problematic because he doesn't have the singing down right. And there's a lot to be said for that. Because when you chant it, you've also got the question and the answer and the attack and everything else is part of that tune. Rabbi Yosha Ber Soloveitchik used to learn very, very slowly, and he used to chant it, and people were very impressed. There was a student who heard him, and he thought he was davening. He thought he was saying Hallel or something, because the tune was very, very, it was very melodious and very beautiful. And he's learning Gemara. And then later on, Rabbi Yosha Ber, he's standing there for davening. It was not melodious at all. It was fairly, so he asked Rabbi Yosha Ber, he said to him, what's going on? He says, I mean, ask him that way, but he said, excuse me, but Rabbi, your learning seems to be much more melodious than your davening. So Rabbi Yosha Ber said, look, he says, when I'm davening, I'm talking to Hashem. When I'm learning, he's talking to me, which is more interesting to you. But so in that sense, but the singing certainly is a part of the learning, and that's the Gemara. That's indeed what the Gemara tells us. Music also is a very important part of our avoda in terms of simcha. If du es Hashem b'simcha, to serve Hashem with simcha is a central idea in Judaism. The Rambam tells us that the doing of mitzvahs b'simcha is avoda gedola hi. It is a great work. It's a great work. You have to work on this continuously. There's no question that the singing together, whether it is miras on Shabbos, whether it is the singing of davening, whether it's the singing of Torah, it's that song also gives us a tremendous amount of simcha. And it's a simcha and it's a joy and a pleasure, which is not a physical pleasure. You know, we always know there are different levels of pleasure. The higher levels of pleasure are those which are not merely physical, but which incorporate also the spiritual. A level of pleasure where you've only, I mean, you just think about it, very simple. If you could take a steak and you could chuck it into the microwave in a browning dish and eat it, right? And the pleasure would be some pleasure. But obviously, if you anticipate the steak and you invite some friends over for the barbecue and you create an atmosphere, etc., etc., much of the pleasure in terms of eating the steak is pretty much the same. But it's the less physical things, the friendship of another person, etc., etc., which enhances the pleasure. Music also is not a merely physical pleasure. Music, we believe, is also can be a ruchnius pleasure, depending on the intent, depending on the type of music, depending on the words, but it's a pleasure which is above the merely physical. And I feel that when I'm singing Zmiris with my children on Shabbos, to me, that's probably the Ma'ein Olam Haba. I mean, there's like an amazing Ma'ein Olam Haba, a taste of the pleasure of the world to come. It's not a physical pleasure, right? From a physical point of view, I'm not ingesting anything. Right? I'm not. It's very, very much a ruchnius idea. It's interesting. William James, the great psychologist, Harvard psychologist, in Will to Believe, points out. He says, if I would ask someone, he talks about materialist view of the world and the spiritual view of the world. He says, if I would ask someone, would you like, for $10, you are invited to witness some cat gut being scraped over some horse's hair tonight? Would anyone pay $10 for that? You want to see cat gut being scraped over horse's hair? Or horse's hair being scraped over cat gut? No, thank you. William James says, but if I were to describe that as a violin concerto, would you now pay $15 for it? Because what is a violin concerto? The materialist looks at it and says, big deal. You got some cat gut stretched over some wood, someone scraping some horse's hair over some cat gut, right? And you want to pay $15 for that? The answer is yeah. So William James says, because one person is looking at it purely from the materialistic perspective, which only looks at the matter, chomer. He says, but we look at things, and when he says we, it's not we, right? But is a Protestant theologian as well as a psychologist. But again, from the point of view of Ruchnius, we look at things, we don't look at it in terms of the physical. The music itself may not have the 100-piece band, may not have the whole orchestra. It may be just like two or three people with not great voices getting together and singing Shiras V'Tishbachos, praises to Hashem, and there's a connection there of the soul to each other and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is like really nothing else. And that's really the spiritual view of it. That's the way we look at it. I also see music as a tremendous metaphor for the whole of Halacha. You know, we believe that every person has a unique role to play within the world, within Judaism, within the world. Everyone has a unique role. But, on the other hand, Halacha is equal to everyone. So how could it be? We have different... Because it's interesting. I think music is a good metaphor for this. Because there's a... the music which is reads the same notes, uses the same instruments, can still be different. I remember I have a friend in Israel, Siegel family. Mrs. Siegel has a doctorate in music. She teaches piano, and her entire family are very musical. She's got one kid who's a drummer, one kid who's guitar, one kid plays a flute. I mean, it's a very musical family. So I was there. Their 7-year-old son Josh was at their house. I was there in the house. There was a tape playing, and the kid says, "Mummy, could you please change the tape? I don't like this one." It was classical music. I think it was. I don't remember what it was, Eine kleine Nacht music, if I remember correctly. And it's playing, and I was enjoying it, and he says, "Oh, could you change the tape?" I said, "Oh, great, we're going to get Uncle Moishi now," or something like that. Anyway, so his mother changes the tape, and she puts in another tape, and it's exactly the same music. It's the same piece of Mozart. So I say, "Nancy, I think you made a mistake. I think you just put the same tape in." So the 7-year-old looks at me with disdain, and he says, "No." He says, "The first one was Herbert von Karajan conducting the Berlin Philharmonic." He says, "This one is Zubin Mehta and St. Martin in the Fields." I wanted to strangle the kid. Come here! You know? So, but again, with someone who is sensitive to that, it's interesting. Zubin Mehta, St. Martin in the Fields, and the Herbert Berlin Philharmonic, they're playing the same instruments. They're the same instruments. They may even be from the same manufacturers. Right? And the music notes they're reading of Mozart are the same notes of music. The same. But when one... But there's a difference, because you also put some of yourself into the music. And that's also true in Halacha. That's also true in the keeping of the mitzvahs. There's a little bit of the self which is expressed in that way, even though they may be, you know, when you see a Litvish Kiddush and you see a Hasidic Kiddush, and even within the Hasidic movement, the Sfaradim and everyone else, there's a very, very beautiful concert of the Jewish people all together, each using the same notes and the same instruments, but each producing a very, very different and interesting music. And the combination, and just as in an orchestra, every single member of the orchestra, even there's a guy who sits there at the back, every 10 minutes he goes like this. You ever seen that guy? What's he called? The timbali guy? The timbali guy? The timbalist, right? Tippinist, sorry. Right? He goes, you know, every 10 minutes, he sits there like reading cartoons or stuff. I don't know what he's doing, writing a novel. Every 10 minutes, bing, you know, that's it. Right? So that's also a contribution. Everyone has a contribution to make into the orchestra, which is the Avodas Hashem, the whole purpose of the Jewish people. And not only is music a metaphor for that contribution, but it's also one of the ways in which we make that contribution, whether it is through our prayers, whether it is through the learning of Torah, whether it is through the type of music that we listen to for inspiration, whether it is the melodies we use in our prayers, the Zmiris on Shabbos. And through all that, hopefully, we can hope to be merit hearing the music of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, when we will hear the Levites singing the songs of Tehillim, of Psalms, in the Beis Hamikdash. We'll hear an orchestra, which is not a swing orchestra or anything like that. It'll be an orchestra which will produce the music, which we'll hear from that music a little bit and get higher and closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One of the most interesting to note, Chazonus is really one of the most authentic Jewish music or art forms that there is. Right, but to a great degree, it's a very rare and unappreciated art form today, because the ideal of Chazanus also is to raise and elevate you. It's not meant to be that I'm sitting back there and just listening to a concert of the Chazan. It's meant to be that the Chazan is taking the whole congregation and taking us with him. You know, it was interesting, I read in Moment magazine, a conservative rabbi had taken over an Orthodox synagogue building. And the first thing he did was, he had the interior decorated, the architect, well, first of all, they moved the bimah from the center of the shul to the front, and they turned it around to face the congregation, which is a standard thing for conservative synagogues to do. He didn't think much about it. He said, but you know what? He said a few months later, because he'd grown up in an Orthodox shul, a few months later he realized, he said, just how serious and negative that change was. He turned, by moving the bimah out of the middle and facing the community, he turned the community from a community into an audience. They're sitting back and they're listening. So that's not what it's meant to be. Even if the chazan is doing the chazanas, the listening should be an active listening, where we are actually also thinking of the words, connecting the music and the words and ourselves to each other and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's really the ideal. So it's a little bit of an introduction to the idea of Jewish music, and we'll talk more about Shira, we'll talk about later in the week, the Shira Sayam specifically, in terms of the Maharal's understanding of it, and cross the Red Sea with the Maharal, and hopefully we'll get a little more of an insight. But this is just a bit of an introduction to Jewish music. I just want to tell you what Rav Moshe Shapiro, the rest of the conversation, that this fellow asked Rav Moshe, he said, would you say that it's okay for me to play music which was originally written for non-Jewish or Christian pieces? And Rav Moshe says, you can listen to Bach. So Rav Moshe's words. He said, music ain't a mekabel tumah. Music does not mekabel tumah. Interesting to note, there's a big machloikas aposkim, I should point out. Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed. Yibodol L'chaim Tov, and Rav Moshe Shapiro says that that's not so, but Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva says that music that was composed for avodah zarah, for idolatry, is not allowed to be listened to. But anyway, I heard from my Rebbe that it was different, is what he said to this fellow who was there with me. And then the fellow asked him, he says, is it okay for me to become a concert violinist? Is that a good career for a Jewish boy? Become a concert violinist? And Rav Moshe Shapiro said, umnas makia v'kala. He described it as a clean and easy trade, which is exactly what the Mishnah says that we should do. So this guy came out, he was in seventh heaven, right? The fact he didn't like singing with people because they were off tune, Rav Moshe Shapiro agreed with him, right? He felt closer to classical music than to classic Jewish music, Rav Moshe Shapiro said, me too, right? It was like unbelievable. So of course what happened was the guy actually did become Frum, and I think now we're learning in Kollel, he dropped it. What can I say? Okay. All right, thank you very much. We'll see you.